In order to empathize, you must listen to the lived experience of our people, of our women. And what I found is that the lived experience is what I would call attritional, in the fact that it's little things all the time, over a long period of time. In terms of diversity, the best person to bring it forward is your white, heterosexual, able-bodied, middle-income father person. Because otherwise we're leaving it to the minority to change the majority.
Captain Tim Grimley's curiosity and constructive criticism led him to discover his own ignorance. His willingness to learn, a great trait for good leaders, resulted in this accidental feminist finding his place as the lead ally to the Naval Service Women's Network. In this role, Grimmers, as he's widely known, is committed to training, educating, and informing other men about how to be better allies. He discusses how this improves team culture and operational effectiveness. For those who think this isn't their fight, I commend Grimmer's grim determination to inform, advise, and encourage bystanders into action. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Grimmers.
I'm a logistics officer by trade, and the best thing about a logistics officer is that you touch pretty much every part of the service and of defence. So I'm a maritime specialist, but all logisticians are defence logisticians in a way. So I've been very lucky from the early ages in the Fleet Air Arm, which is where I ended up now, over to the submarine service, to general service, so frigates, and spent some time with the army as well. So Herrick and Shader, as well as time in Ministry of Defence and PGHQ. So the good thing I like about logisticians is that you do get the broad range, perhaps, you know, jack of all, master of none, but I've been very lucky in that respect.
And in addition to this busy world of work that you have, you've got an additional hat and role. Can you talk about what that is, please?
I've landed myself with a title which is the lead ally to the Naval Service Women's Network. And allyship has been growing exponentially, I think, in the last 2 or 3 years. It's a role I've sort of done since 2021. And to say the role found me more than I found the role would be very much true, because I was actually trying to criticise someone in what they were doing, in a helpful way, I hope. And they turned around and said, well, actually, what we really need is a male ally on our committee. Are you free? I'd recently promoted to commander at that time, and I was in our warfare centre, maritime warfare centre, which gave me this breadth and space to think, one of the few jobs in defence that allows you to do that. So I didn't really know much about it. I had some experience previously on staff course, because my master's was on this topic that was related. And I suppose it was really the master's that opened my eyes to the journey and my own ignorance. I thought, well, if I can get to commander and be ignorant, then other people are going to be ignorant. So I took it on.
And what was your master's in?
It is Defence Studies Master's. And what had happened in defence recently, there was a couple of policy announcements that actually rubbed me up the wrong way. So I thought, great, I'm going to do a dissertation and I'm going to prove defence wrong. The first policy dates back to SDSR 2015. Mm-hmm. Where defence was going to commit to a minimum number of women, gender quotas, by 2020. I started my master's in 2019, and we knew we were nowhere near getting gender quotas as a defence and as a navy. But that wasn't the issue I had. The issue I had is, why have gender quotas? My first boss in the navy was female. You know, we see all these adverts about Stonewall, you know, navy's amazing, defence is amazing, and promotion is on merit. And that was always, you know, drilled into us. It doesn't matter who you are, what your background is, promotion is on merit. So my starting point is, if we've got all these things, why do we need gender quotas? Over the sort of 9 months of doing your master's, I realised that actually I was very ignorant. And that was a very sort of shallow view of why we have these sort of interventions. Now, don't get me wrong, I still generally disagree with gender quotas. I've got to be careful, I'm disagreeing with defence policy. But it opened my eyes to a lot of other problems in the diversity sphere. And I chose one branch, which is gender. And so that's why the Naval Service Women Network really sort of resonated with what I can do.
Your disinclination for quotas, is it because it risks driving perverse behaviours?
I think so. I think people talk about positive discrimination. If you've got a quota, then that will drive behaviours. It's a target. what the sort of Masters concluded is that what gender quotas does is try and address the asymmetry of statistics, man versus women, which completely skips over the masculine versus feminine side of the diversity debate. If you set gender quotas based on your physical sex, you're never going to get behind the cultural change, which is what defence was actually after. That is why I sort of disagreed with it and still disagree with it today. I think it could be a good benchmark to see how you are doing, but it should never be considered a target.
I think it has a purpose, but it would be better if one didn't have to go through setting those kind of quotas or targets.
Absolutely. But I suppose one of the things we've also got to realise that we're a bottom-led organisation. Therefore, it will take time from the uniform perspective to fill the top ranks. And we're making an assumption that you need a woman in the post with influence and power in order to bring about cultural change. And that sits uncomfortably with me, because what we're basically saying is that men can't bring about cultural change. I would switch it on its head and say, let's choose the right rear admirals to go to vice admiral that has the right cultural nous and strategic thinking, which is a clear sort of golden thread from your previous podcast. But you can have men do that, whilst hopefully the women will have a critical mass where we turn from inequality to justice.
You said that the Naval Service Women's Network approached you, and some of our listeners won't know what the Naval Service Women's Network is and does. Another way of describing it would be an employee resource group. Is that a fair description?
I think that description almost does a disservice, because it sounds very transactional. It sounds like an initiative or a club. My experience with the NSN is that it's far from that. It's a force to be reckoned with. It was like-minded people clearly facing the same injustice, but not knowing what to do with it. It was a resource group. It was a help group, sharing not just ideas, not just the problems, best practice, where to go. Everything from someone who's going on maternity leave, they don't have access to uniform clothing, how can they get the next set of clothing and rigs? Changes in policy, what does it mean? And it's a very quick go-to place, as opposed to having to draft or read through thousands of pages of policy.
I know that in some women's networks, they particularly want to have safe spaces for women-only conversations to happen. As a man in a network that's predominantly for women, how have you navigated through that?
The easy answer to that is show my ignorance and be upfront about that ignorance and show that you want to learn. I think to be the best ally, you need to get high on E, which is high on empathy. And if you are high on empathy, you are 50% of being an amazing ally. And my experience is going into a room saying, I don't know the answer, and I'm not here to fix anything, because I think that is a big mistake. We're here to fix you, which is clearly not what we're trying to achieve.
I'm also conscious that we're two blokes talking about what some people might say are women's issues. I would challenge them on that. I think that what we're talking about are human issues, and that it needs all people of all genders to be involved in the conversation in order for change to genuinely happen. Is that what your experience has been?
I'd go one step further. I'd say that it would be harsh for us to expect 10% of our population, our female population, to change the attitudes of the 90%, especially when the 90% caused the environment in the first place. Actually, having two or three or four men is helpful. Having 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 men is better. Because at the moment, if you look at some of the roles that are in diversity roles across defence, they're predominantly made up by women. But I'd like to think that we're getting to a position where men can actually take charge of the injustices that we created. I think we men, the 90%, have to see ourselves as accountable. So actually, in terms of diversity, the best person to bring it forward is your white, heterosexual, able-bodied, middle-income father person, because otherwise we're leaving it to the minority to change the majority.
With that change, part of the work that I know you do is around education and learning and training. How have you taken that approach to training?
The most fundamental thing for me is to stop talking about diversity as a function of law. The starting point is we're ethical. So being able to rattle off protective characteristics, being able to rattle off what Act of Parliament it is, is really unhelpful because it puts the center of gravity on law. You're doing something because it's wrong. If you put the center of gravity on culture, on leadership, then it changes the thinking. We talk about training, that's a skill set. We can train people how to talk better. What we don't seem to do as much in the diversity world is talk about attitudes. And for me, attitude is a function of leadership, moral courage, courage in your conviction, a positive working environment. And it's about being an ethical leader, and it's about combat power as well. And I think if we tell our seniors and the people in charge of the leadership schools that actually you are in charge of diversity, not Navy people, not defense people, but the Leadership Academy, you're in charge of diversity, I think it will change our dynamics slightly.
In the training of attitudes or the education of attitudes and it being a leadership space, how are you approaching that in your role as an advocate?
I think for me, my golden thread, especially coming from the Maritime Warfare Centre, is putting it as a function of lethality. I think that lands best with our warfighters. I'm very lucky to be able to talk to, you know, commanding officers and hopefully moving into the executive branch and warrant officers, senior NCOs. There's a line I always open up with, which is embracing inclusivity might not be what you signed up for. In fact, you might indeed regard it as a distraction to beating the enemy into a pulp, which is what we're all here for. But once you realize how much harm is being done to your people, to your combat effectiveness, and to your lethality, then you realize you cannot defeat the enemy without tackling diversity. And I think it's best put by Steve Prest, who was one of our strongest allies and continues to be, who said, "We should leave the business of disheartening and alienating our own people to the enemy. We should under no circumstances do their job for them." And so moving the narrative away from it's a legal thing, learn the Act of Parliament, to the enemy's going to defeat us. We are handing victory to the enemy, I think puts the narrative on the correct footing.
That's very powerful quotation I read in your evidence that you submitted to the House Commons Defence Committee Women in the Armed Forces Inquiry. Focusing on operational effectiveness is one way of looking at how to generate the best high-performing teams. But do you think that the approach to that is different when we're on shore or in barracks? Do you think that the approach is different when we're thinking in a war-fighting sense, but we're not on operations?
Actually, I think it's quite the opposite. I think when we're not on operations, we have a peacetime luxury, which is why perhaps we haven't been getting after this with the same impetus as we should, because it's been a long time since we've been in high-end kinetic activity. War has a habit of advancing the things that we need to advance, be it medicine, be it arms. And I think this is one of the things that would advance very quickly with war. And I can evidence that with some of the examples that have come out recently. So, for example, in COVID, the lack of PPE really brought to the conversation on the front pages how bad PPE affects the health service. And there was a really good doctor, Dr. Arkhaven, if I've pronounced that correctly. She was an ICU doctor and a scholar in residence at Stanford University. And she evidenced on a day-to-day basis how the PPE she was being provided was not fit for her as a woman, because these are unisex PPE, goggles at unisex and gloves at unisex. And the gloves are a really good case in point. We talk about the warfighting side, because gloves are based on a male human hand. Women, generally speaking, have longer fingers and a smaller palm. An ICU doctor having to get gloves that doesn't fit her based on the ergonomics of a man worries me, because if you were in the front line and you were hit and you were taken to your aid station and your doctor was wearing gloves that doesn't fit and hinders your recovery, you'd be pretty pissed off. Try tying shoelaces with ill-fitting gloves. You can't do that. Try doing heart surgery, and I suspect it's even worse. Why do I think there's an operational imperative? Take body armor. Well documented. Ministry of Defence turned a really good corner back in 2022 about recognising that the female body is not the same as a male body. Discuss why did it take so long. And now there are various types and sizes. But even now, there are some criticisms that the minimum size of our current body armour doesn't fit the minimum size of our people, and especially women who are, on average would be shorter than their men. In 1997, in New York Police, it was uncovered that a number of women were having breast reduction surgery in order to be able to wear the body armor that was issued to them because it was just causing too much harm. And this came to light when there was a female New York police officer that was killed because she took her body armor off to use a battering ram because she could not use it whilst wearing this male-designed body armor. When that came to light, I think it was about 700 women came forward with similar examples where they can't work effectively with their body armor. And we see that even within our own armed forces, and lots of women actually spoken to me and said, pistol shooting. If you've got ill-fitting body armor, you can't shoot a rifle, you can't shoot a pistol. That makes you combat ineffective. We, the organization, have done that to you. So yes, I absolutely think it should be about combat effectiveness and not a peacetime luxury.
This conversation reminds me that I had the great pleasure of hearing Caroline Criado Perez speaking at the Army Service Women's Network Conference in, I think, 2020. And she talked about her book and gave examples from her book, Invisible Women. I then read the book and I thought I was an expert in diversity and inclusion, and yet there was so much that I still had to learn. Are the books and articles that you would recommend for other men who recognise that they have blind spots and want to get better informed and become more effective leaders?
Without doubt, there's one article that I share often from the US Military Review in 2016, the US Army Research Institute, and it was called Bias of the Incumbent. And what I like about this article, it uncovers how defence would be different today if women got there first. So men got there first, and so our defence is designed around men. And when we talk about recent times about women serving in the infantry, serving in combat roles, submarine service, the narrative went, well, can women do this? What I love about this article, The Bias of the Incumbent, is what was if women were here first? And when you read it, you conclude that men would not be allowed to be Royal Marines, not be allowed infantiers. Men would not be allowed on tanks or submarines. And they evidence it very well. For example, take the fast jet. The cockpit is designed around men. Men are, on average, taller. If women were here first, the cockpits would be generally smaller, which means, on average, men wouldn't be allowed to be fighter pilots. They wouldn't allowed to be in tanks. They wouldn't be allowed to be in submarines, because then defence would have to make adjustments for men who are taller. But the article also talks about the logistics chain. Men need more calories than women to do the same activity. And in the article, it talks about a sort of average 30% more calories that men need. So men will be a logistics burden. And as a logistician, when you think about operational advantage and you're trying to get every bit about operational advantage over the gun line, well, why would I choose men? Because that's a burden. So men would actually find it difficult competing for these high, intense, active things, such as the Royal Marines. Men wouldn't be allowed to serve in the Arctic. They wouldn't be allowed to serve in hot climes, everywhere we serve, really, if we're being honest with ourselves. I have to read this bit because I get it wrong. If men joined after women, we would need estrogen supplements for better lipid utilization for energy metabolism. What it basically means is women are at less risk of heat illness. Women are less prone to acute mountain sickness, which means if men came in second, if defense didn't want to make adjustments, then men would not be allowed to be in the Marines or the infantry or in tanks.
I think that concept of flipping is really powerful, and not just in the medical space. There's a whole bunch of other applications that one could do that flipping. The uncomfortableness of that heresy that actually is not heretical, it's just what has been before because of how it started. And that's not always a good place to come up with a plan.
And that's why gender quotas, whilst it could be a benchmark, it could be a tool, it would only work if used against so many other things that we talk about, be it, you know, the success of wraparound childcare at the moment, giving the opportunities to wean out these injustices. There's actually a good toolkit, which is in the form of a book, but it's not a start, middle and end. It's a you can dip in and dip out style book, which is called The Accidental Sexist, written by two men and a woman, Gary Ford, Seaman Cock, and Dr. Jill Armstrong. I was very fortunate to meet Dr. Jill when she did some male ally workshops for us in defence. And the powerful argument that she put across at the start of these meant I just had to buy the book and find it out for myself. And I've since bought about 30 or 40 copies and pass it out to various men and male allies. Not because everything in it is true, because it gets you to think, it gets you to stare out the window. For example, she talks about allies needing power and balance. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think you could be an able rate, you could be a soldier, and be just as powerful ally as a senior officer. But it's very good because it sets out the number one question I get from an ally, which is, what can I do? Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm ethical, I want to be a leader, I now learn what is wrong, but what can I do? And that is the number one question I often get.
Do you have any top tips for how to be a better male ally?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the first thing I would say is going back to what I was saying about let's get high on E. Let's get high on empathy. That gets you 50% there. The second one is just listen. And if you listen to the lived experience, if you were like me, you'll be blown away with how often it's happening and then how many different forms it's happening. For example, I often thought that the problem we had with diversity were really bad people. I don't think defence is that bad because I don't think we've got really bad people. But what I've learned is allyship is not about the 1% that does the real bad, what I call the pulse warfare, the shock and awe. In order to empathise, you must listen to the lived experience of our people, of our women. And what I found is that the lived experience is what I would call attritional, in the fact that it's little things all the time, over a long period of time. No one thing in itself would sort of justify, you know, the service police getting involved or justify a service complaint. But the accumulation of it certainly does. But the problem is, accumulation of it is organisational, and it's hard to put a service complaint in against organisation or culture. We focus training on the absolute worst of the worst, the shock and awe, and less on the attritional. And what I mean by pulse warfare in this context is the really bad people. The people who rape, who seek out prostitutes, who create a toxic environment there and then. We know that is the vast minority of people. I think where the diversity training needs to come in is address the vast majority, such as people like myself, who were ignorant to the microaggressions that our service women are facing on a day-to-day basis. And those microaggressions could be anything from PPE that's unisex, but we know it's just for men. It might be the microaggressions, which might be simple as a sign that says officers and duty men only. It might be an invitation card that says or female equivalent, because we're just setting people up to fail, because I don't know what female equivalent is. So how am I supposed to teach the people that work for me? It's language such as, you know, man up. And it's also, you know, in terms of microaggressions, they talk about impact versus intent. I could have really good intent by saying, you're just one of the lads. Because my intent would be to say, I don't see you as a weak person. But the impact is the individual saying, I don't want to be a lad. I'm really proud of who I am. So train on microaggressions, train on language, and train on these attritional impacts to women's life. And the third part of what can an ally do is look at reward versus punishment. Call out what is good. I don't think we do that enough. I think it's getting better. Award ceremonies are good. Recognizing it in people's appraisals is good, all up and down the ranks. And calling it out and showing to other people that, yes, you might be the best navigator, you might be the best sniper, but actually you're a best leader of people because you did X, Y, and Z. And put that on the same weighting and footing as any other combat power. I had a case very recently at a lieutenant commander, a major equivalent who works for us. He had a leading hand, corporal equivalent, who was targeted over the summer months for being from the Commonwealth and the riots this country had. And my lieutenant commander, without any prompting, took this individual, took their family, found welfare accommodation, found them transport, took them out of the area of which they would be threatened, and looked after them, looked after the family on a long-term basis. And that's because this individual realised that as functional leadership, we need to look after our people. This person was attacked, not on service time, not on a service base, but still belonged to us, and we need to look after them. It's incumbent on me to reward that individual. In terms of punishment, I think we're really good at raising the level of awareness of punishment in terms of rape and rape cases and the standard of evidence, and that's very difficult. But with terms of punishment, I think we need to do more in terms of the bystanders. There's a great quote by an anonymous army contributor to the HEDC written evidence. She said, "Until the observers are punished as severely as those who perpetrate the crimes, the culture will never change." And this individual then resigned from the army. And what I got from that and many other submissions in that written evidence is that these individuals hate the men that rape and do sexual assault. What they also hate is the organization that knew about it and did nothing about it. And that is what we've still yet to address. So punishment, not just of the offender, but the bystanders as well.
You've talked about some progress that's been made and some of the evidence that you've seen to support that. What's changed that you are pleased about, and what more change would you want to see?
I think that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because when I go on this conversation, I often talk about the worst of defence and talk about the bad lived experience. But there is so much that is going on that is really good. We had a great example at RNAS Yeovilton very recently, where a clear sign was coming from the Naval Service Women in the room saying, the shop on base doesn't have the right sanitary products. So I looked at it and I saw that there were tampons and there's some pads. And I said, well, what's wrong? And as blunt as it could be, this individual turned around and said, boss, virgins don't wear tampons. And I froze and I went bright red. And then I had to learn about sanitary products. And so I learned that actually some virgins do wear tampons. Some people don't prefer it. Some people prefer applicators or not applicators, branded products, not branded products. And there is a difference in terms of flow. None of which I knew, yet I was responsible for being the intelligent customer of this store. We all went on this journey of discovery and understanding, but quick as a flash, they came back and went, we realize this now, let's change it. And I believe that's been changed across the defense estate. So progress is definitely being made. If there's one area of progress I think we need to get over, is assuming that this all sits on our senior leadership. There was a letter very recently by a large number of senior civil servants into the Ministry of Defence. It basically said, there is a corrupt culture, there is a culture that's toxic here. So Vice Chief very quickly wrote a letter out, and I read it, and my initial reaction was, you're not taking charge of this. I really recommend Googling accountability ladder. And it talks about victim behaviours, and victims' behaviours are, I didn't know about this, this is someone else's problem, why didn't someone tell me, I haven't got any levers to do this. And I read the letter and I thought, this sounds like a victim, this is not a very good letter, this isn't defence taking charge. And then when I looked into some of the policies are there. So what's failing? And I think what's failing is, whilst we expect 5 people in senior leadership, 10 people in senior leadership to change culture, we seem to be ignoring the 30,000 people, the 100,000 people, 130,000 people across the fence that need to change culture as well. And I think we are all exhibiting these victim attitudes. I think it's the senior leadership to change culture. I think where progress is being made and needs to be made more is teaching everyone at every rank and grade that they have a part to play in changing culture. And the way we do that goes again back to leadership. So the mandatory training on diversity is the same for an ABLE rate as it is for First Sea Lord. How is it that we don't appreciate the nuance and the difference in experiences and knowledge and education going across the rates from junior NCO to senior NCO? How do we not recognise that as people progress through the service, that people have greater capacity to learn? I don't know if First Sea Lord does his mandatory training as I do, but I suspect it's beneath him because he's at such a high plane. Our greatest advocates and allies in the Naval Service Women are the warrant officers of Second Sea Lord and Fleet Commander. And I know that they would knock that training out of the park and deliver something really phenomenal to the senior NCO cadre. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to progress the level of metis we apply to this.
Grimmers offers excellent practical advice for all allies and ethical leaders. he is clear that everyone, regardless of rank or grade, has a key role to play in improving culture and behaviour. This requires action to address the small stuff because, ultimately, it harms combat effectiveness and lethality. I am recording this in Movember, and the impatient colonel wants to say, don't just grow a moustache in Movember, but grow a pair and take action to stop bad behaviour. But the considered colonel is saying, we all need to learn how better to do this. Back in March, for International Women's Day, I wrote a blog offering practical tips about being a male ally. We have put the link in the show notes, and I would be keen to hear your recommendations. Send me an email at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.